Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. This episode deals with matters that some listeners may find troubling. If you or someone you know is experiencing suicidal thoughts, please talk with someone you trust. You can access information about 24-hour crisis centers in your community and across Canada at suicideprevention.ca. And in the United States, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or via suicidepreventionlifeline.org to chat with someone online. You matter. We need you here. Please take care of yourself and reach out if you need help. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hi, this is Mark Lee Morrison from the podcast Low Profile. I live in Olympia, Washington with my wife and two daughters, and I support Vish Khanna's Creative Control on Patreon because I appreciate his journalistic integrity. Vish talks with a lot of artists I care about, and he never asks any boring questions. I love hearing his interviews, and as a Patreon supporter, I get to hear even more of them. If you enjoy Creative Control too, I implore you to join me as a sustaining contributor.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Suk-Yin Lee is an award-winning filmmaker, musician, actor, visual artist, and broadcaster based in Toronto, Ontario. Originally from British Columbia, Lee first gained notice for her role in the band Bob's Your Uncle and then went on to work as an on-air personality and producer for Canada's music channel, Much Music, before taking on a similar role at CBC Radio, where she hosted the show Definitely Not the Opera. Also renowned for her work as a filmmaker and an actress, whose credits include the innovative 2006 film about sex and sexuality, Short Bus, Lee has maintained an active musical practice since she was a teenager. Along with her partner, friend, and accomplished musician and film score artist Adam Litovitz, Lee released an album called Juge in 2015, and the pair began working on a follow-up in recent years. Sadly, after battling depression, Litovitz committed suicide in June of 2019, leaving Lee devastated but resolute in her belief that their work in progress must be completed. And so we have this gift. On April 9th, 2021, Mint Records will release Juge 2, and Suk-Yin and I reconnected for a conversation about Adam and their lives together, her upbringing, Chinese heritage, and intergenerational family trauma, how she got into making art and into broadcasting, the freedom of expression she had at Much Music, the sound and character of Juge 2, future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past and recent podcast guests like Tanya Tagak, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 606th episode of Creative Control, featuring the multi-talented Suk-Yin Lee, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Suk-Yin. How are you?
I'm very well, Vish. So nice to see you, or actually I can't see you, but speak with you after a long time.
It's nice to talk to you again. Yeah, we were seeing each other for a moment when we had the video on, and now it's gone, but I can hear you, and you sound good, and you look good moments ago, so it is very nice to see you. Where in the world are you today?
Well, I'm in my house where I've been sequestered for over a year. It's pretty ripe in here. but you know, I'm used to it. Have you ever seen the movie? There's a movie called Woman of the Dunes. It's a classic Japanese film, black and white, and it takes place in an enclave of desert dwellers who live under the surface of the earth in sand dunes. And the whole movie takes place in the subterranean home of this one woman in a sand dune. So it's kind of been my life has been a bit Woman of the Dunes over here.
Well, is that good? I've not seen the film, so I don't know how it ends up. Does it end badly?
Yeah. Well, both. I mean, you know, there's liberation and also incarceration. So, you know, life cuts both ways.
Yes, I think that's true generally, even if you're not in a pandemic. So, yeah. You are from British Columbia originally, is that correct?
I am, yeah. I grew up in, well, I'm originally from Lynn Valley, at the foot of the Big Rocky Mountains in North Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Vancouver as a teenager and grew up there. And then I moved to Toronto for my first job when I got the gig as a VJ.
Right. Okay. And that's where you are still to this day. You're in Toronto?
I am. Yeah. I'm in Toronto.
Yeah. So how have things been? You've described it briefly in terms of your self-inflicted lockdown incarceration, as you put it, I believe. How have things been for you overall this past year? I ask this question all the time. I've gotten some very interesting answers. For some, it has been an interestingly reflective period, you know, a stop, pausing, thinking about things kind of time. For others, it's really frustrating and can't wait to get back to normal. How would you characterize your own emotional response to what we've all been going through?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. And these days I can really only respond to it from moment to moment, because everything's been very, very intense these last few years. There's been a tremendous upheaval and difficulty, and then moments of incredible beauty and joy. So, I mean, and everything in between, boredom and ridiculousness and fun times. Yeah. At this moment, I'm really happy to be here talking with you. So it's really hard for me to even to say what it's been like. But, you know, in this moment, speaking with you, Vish, is fantastic.
Okay, that's good.
I mean, I think that it's been a dynamic time, a really dynamic time. One thing is I'm really used to, I was just raised in a way that really promoted a lot of internal, interior-mindedness. Mm-hmm. I come from a family of introverts. You know, I phone up my pops and I'm like, hey, Dad, how's it going? He's like, oh, it's the same. You know, I spend a lot of time myself. Like, he wakes up and dances and he, you know, does his putters around and does his gardening and stuff like that. He's like, you know me, I just like know how to. So it's very, very simple to be sequestered. And I'm also a writer. Writers know what it's like to spend hours and hours on their butt by themselves.
Yeah.
So I've always had to like kind of make my own fun in an interior world. And I tend to be a homebody. That said, I mean, this entire time is, I mean, it's been so, so very, very interesting in terms of, yeah, having to create and carve a space out in this very strange time. Meanwhile, world events, volatility of world events going all around us, and then trying to find a space where you can kind of be okay with your own brain. A lot of people have a hard time being with their brain because, like, you know, to look at yourself in that way can be sometimes troubling. But by and large, I mean, the events of the last few years have been very challenging. I lost my partner and my best friend and my partner in mischief making and art making, Adam Litovitz. We were together for 12 years. Mm. He died. And that was my own personal kind of devastating moment. And, you know, it continues to be. It's very difficult to live in the absence in a world without Adam in it. I mean, I still feel him in a lot of ways of which I'm unable to really aptly describe. But just getting used to his non-physical presence here is challenging. Although I say that right now, and there is a photo of him on the wall staring directly at me. So I feel him always in some way. But when the pandemic hit, you know, I really felt like, wow, you know, compared to the experience of losing Adam, this pandemic is a cakewalk. Hmm. It's I felt that it had psychologically prepared me for, like, I had already hit the worst and life could possibly get even worse than that. But at least I kind of had an adjustment. And so, you know, I think as an artist, I do feel part of my job is to reflect, of course, my own experience, but the world around and this time of global lockdown and all of the things that are happening is just so incredibly interesting and inspiring. So this last year has been very fruitful in terms of productivity and creativity. I've been inspired to make a feature movie in lockdown. It's called Death and Sickness. And it was a sort of auto fiction derived from real life, derived from my relationship with Adam, losing Adam, the pandemic falling upon us, being thrust into a very unusual situation, deciding to lock down with my friend who I just met, who is virtually a stranger, Dylan Gamble, at that point. And together, the two of us made this very experimental, funny and sad, heartbreaking and surreal and wonderful film. And it was just the two of us that made it together. We did sound, edited, acted, the whole thing. And then I was able to get CBC Gem to license it. And then so I was able to share that with people. And then now working on the album that Adam and I began and almost completed. We had eight of the 11 songs done. It was very clear to me. We were very, very proud of this album and excited about the work we were doing. And it was very clear that I would finish it and release it. And so that's coming out too. So, you know, in a lot of ways, not only did this pandemic give me a space to consider and work with this world without Adam in, you know, a physical presence, and also sort of consider what it is in the world right now, because really, I really felt that what I was experiencing was a microcosm of the loss that so many people are feeling right now.
Yeah.
You know, loss of our world as we knew it, loss of some of our loved ones, loss of our well-being and health. There's so many losses and then some small gains as well.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to extend my condolences to you. I mean, this isn't quite in person, but I think I probably did what a lot of people did and extended them to you at the time via social media. But I do want to say that I'm sorry. I actually have a fond recollection of running into you and Adam in Kensington Market once, just randomly. And it was just, I sat down with you for a little bit. I don't know what I was doing, but yeah, I did feel badly for you. I appreciate that you were able to overcome that on some level, you know, and make things. And I want to talk more about Adam and these the new Juge. Am I pronouncing this word correctly?
Everybody always asks, you know, Adam and I love words. He especially was a man of words. Mm. I mean, he was writing words like his dad put fridge magnets on the fridge, and he was like less than two when his dad noticed he was putting those little toy fridge magnets in word formation.
Oh.
So his mother was poet Malka Litovitz, very beloved poet based in Toronto. She has also passed. And so Adam inherited this incredible gift for words. And so when we came up with our name, J-O-O-J, we were not attached to the way people pronounced it, but we loved the way the words looked on the page. And so we never prescribed how it was to sound. We delighted in all the variations that people would say the name. A lot of people say Juge. A lot of people say Juge. Some say I was just Juge. Talking with...
They add a little oomph to it, a little French, Parisian kind of Juge. Okay, interesting.
And I think that's a French word. It's a funny word that's like, oh, give it some zhuzh. It's sort of like a kind of like, as I understand, I think somebody who is like in artistic circles had said, yeah, it's kind of an attitude, like kind of like a, it's not like je ne sais quoi, but it's almost like, it's a very specific thing where it's kind of like you're precocious.
Yeah.
As a precociousness.
Right.
And then some people say, Joe OJ or J-O-J.
Really?
Huh. And, you know, but I personally love to see, especially in either all caps or small caps, the symmetry there.
Yes.
And it really felt like an echo of Adam and I. Yeah. And secretly, I would think it was an acronym for Joy of Our Joys. But I would, you know, I think Adam probably would be like, that's super sucky.
Well, like I say, I do want to talk about your music with Adam in a moment, but you invoked a number of things there, including dynamism, I suppose we'll call it. You are known as a broadcaster, a musician, you're an actor, you're a filmmaker, an artist, visual artist. You mentioned that you're writing more, and you also mentioned that you're kind of introspective, or at least you occupy a lot of your time is occupied in your interior mind. And I wonder how all of that sort of works together to be what we call a multi-hyphenate or whatever. You do so many things, and yet you're kind of describing yourself as a self-contained, self-sufficient person. So I just kind of want to home in on that a little bit, this notion of you being kind of, you know, private and used to doing things on your own by yourself, but at the same time you extend into all of these artistic communities. It's like you're reaching out and trying to connect to as many people as possible Am I onto something with that? What do you make of that?
No, I really love that. That's what you've sort of honed in on, Vish. Yeah. So I think it's paradoxical, very paradoxical. I mean, it's really, I understand life, and progressively more so, is oftentimes paradoxical. We're living in a type of social media era where it's very easy to express oneself in a slogan, in a kind of like make a singular assertion.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, I just don't see that. Doesn't really jibe with my world. As soon as I make a singular assertion, the equal and opposite makes itself apparent as well, and it draws my attention equally.
Yeah.
As well as all the sort of gray stuff in the middle. So, you know, a lot of people, they assume that I am very extroverted because, you know, they have seen my work or they know me as a communicator. And I think fundamentally, I am both. You know, I think as a child born, as most children are, we are playful and engaged and speak very directly. Children seem to do that.
Yeah.
And I was very, very expressive, putting on big shows for my neighbors and stuff like that. But then, you know, there came a time where all of that shut down, you know, and that probably coincided with being a tween or a teen, where, you know, suddenly feeling like I wasn't sure of who I was or all of my perspectives or where I stand, or I felt dumb, you know, and so shut up. I you know, became very, very shy. So yeah, that is also a big part of me as well.
Yeah.
And that all coincided with the kind of like inner turmoil within my family. I'm first generation Chinese Canadian, and my sisters and I grew up in a very kind of working middle class suburb that was mostly white. So feeling not only a sort of alienation culturally from, you know, my Chinese, I don't feel China Chinese, I don't feel Hong Kong Chinese, I don't feel Canadian. You know, the tin flute never really made sense to me. I don't, like, there's a lot of cultural monikers that are very quintessentially, you know, quote unquote, Canadian, that I didn't really know where I fit. So of course that made it even more feelings of isolation. And my family's very strict. So, you know, a lot of time was spent inside or watching TV or just with my sisters or me just wandering around by myself in the woods, you know?
Yeah.
And so couple that with, I'm beginning to start to see it. And it's only been in the last 5 years or so as a kind of like, I'm an extension of intergenerational trauma. Both of my parents come from incredibly extreme situations. My father, an orphan growing up in Toronto, his parents and his brothers died during war. His brother died in incarceration during wartime. My mom growing up in the Cultural Revolution, you know, both of my parents, you know, people talk about, they talk about family trees or returning to ancestral homes. I do not come from that lineage. My family does not know where they're from. My father only recollects through the memories of an orphan. So we don't have this kind of family tree that we can look at. Mm. We only have the memories of my dad as a child,
right,
which are incredible. And so, you know, growing up in, I mean, it's amazing to see that my father and I and my mother and I, you know, in one generation, here I am speaking with you today, and my life is greatly improved. At the same time, I grew up in a very volatile situation where there was a lot of violence and mental unwellness in my home. And I really had to kind of figure it out. I ended up running away when I was 15. My younger sister as well ran away. So it was challenging. And I feel there was a lot of intensity in that space, in that home front. And I think of much of my communication, I really had to strive to understand what was going on, especially with regards to my mom, who is a very volatile and irrational person. And I had to try to understand because she was my mother and my greatest love and my greatest perpetrator. So, you know, from a young age, I've just been using an inquiring mind to try to understand what that was. And I think when I discovered art and my first real form, well, I was, you know, even as a teenager, when I left home, I was always forbidden to do art. It was like you were going to be a doctor or a lawyer.
This is this is all resonating with me. I don't have the volatility, and luckily, but all of this is resonating with me. Being born to first generation Canadian, being born to immigrants from India.
Yes,
it sounds like you have and very much, live a practical life. Don't stick out. Conform. Do conventional things. Like, that's how I was raised too. So I don't mean to interject, but I think this is an immigration experience.
I think so.
Yeah.
So that idea of like seeing it in the lens of intergenerational trauma, it wasn't just exclusive. Like, we are, these strifes and struggles are passed down genetically, and through experience, and also our socialization, how we are raised. And so I see that in so many people, in immigrants. You see it in the Jewish experience, the Palestinian experience, all people who have struggled.
Well,
that's mostly everybody.
Yeah, and I do think, like, I've brought this up on the show with other people before. If you actually stop and think about immigration, it's very wild. Like, the notion that you would move away from your parents across the world to a place you've never been to make a life for yourself. I've not ever really spoken to my parents about this. It came up like at a dinner once when I was a kid. Like, why did you move from India to Canada? And the simple answer I got, and by the way, this followed them trumpeting India as the greatest country in the world. Like, oh my goodness, nothing is better. We have such pride. You have to have pride in being Indian. I'm like, but you moved away from it. How good could it be? Why did you move? And my mom just said, after a pause, to live a better life. And you're like, okay, I've never really gotten into why, like, if you think about it, why do people move? Like, they're trying to find something, but they're also probably trying to get away from something. And I'll never, maybe ever know what drove my dad to move, like to go to Canada. And then my mom came with him, and you're just like, what, how, can you imagine that? Like, explaining that to someone now, as an adult, like, I mean, yeah, sorry. In our case, there's trauma there. I think there must be something traumatic there, but you sound like you've gotten to that a little bit. Like, you've got some information.
I mean, when you say that, I think all of our families come here in seeking opportunity. You know, in terms of my own cultural history, a lot of people from China ended up coming to Golden Mountain to work on the railroad, mm-hmm. thinking that it was a land of opportunity. Of course, they were subjugated and exploited, and many died working on the railway, and were not even thanked or invited to the opening of the railway, of which they built.
And were separated
from their families after that by the head tax. Mm-hmm. You go thinking, oh shit, this is hard here. I'm going to go over there because it's going to be great. And, in my family's case, it was great. Like, I have so many opportunities.
Yeah.
And yet what happens is also, like, my father, similar to your family, now he's like, he really is so loving of China. And it's funny because he's a part of diaspora in that he was not born in China. He was raised in Hong Kong during the British rule. But because he was separated from his country and he doesn't even know that relationship, there's a wish to return, just like salmon going home to spawn.
Yeah.
And he really, he is also very quick to recognize the incredible racism that has occurred. Will only ever support China and I'll try to bring up, various rights abuses and so forth, and he'll acknowledge them, but he'll say, he still has a heart for his homeland, of which he doesn't even know, and which I think beats even stronger because you are uprooted and removed. So, I mean, all of these things, his side was his orphan side was the sort of really well-adjusted side of the family. My mom's story of struggle and difficulty as a young person stuck into mental health institutions that were really scary at that point in North America, butchery, one would say, and surviving that as a young person and coming out really not well from that system, and then raising kids in isolation. I understand why she was full of anger and rage and turned on her children. I understand it. It doesn't feel good and it doesn't make sense. And it fostered all kinds of weird stuff in me. But getting back to that question of the multi-hyphenate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that all of those questions about humanity, the core question of how could my mom, who is my greatest love and my greatest perpetrator, how can that be? You know, and that extends to everything, everything in the world. So yeah. I think that as a young person, art saved my life. I was very, very shy. When I left home, I started to make videos, films, enter contests, playwriting contests. I suddenly was able to express all this stuff, questions in my head in art. And I was able to get many opportunities to, I was a constant like contest entry person.
Right.
And that's how I got my first movie made for through the NFB, my first playwright. You know, I entered a young playwrights competition and won and got my play produced by a local Toronto or Vancouver theater company. And just all this kind of thing, I left home and my extended family were musicians. And so I grew up in a time in Vancouver where that was great. I mean, it was a very dynamic mix of like punks and choreographers and dancers and poets.
Yeah.
And filmmakers and visual artists all combining and working on each other's projects. And that was at a time where there were no clubs. You know, if you wanted to put on a show, you rented the Ukrainian hall, mm-hmm. you know, or the mm-hmm. Japanese hall
yeah.
and put on this big show. And like, it was a very political climate, very activistically minded, very creative. And I grew up in Chinatown. I was embraced by a queer community, a lesbian community who were my sisters and my parents. And I ended up being able to form a band. Bob's Your Uncle was yeah. my first band. I was still a teenager.
Yeah.
And all those people I met through the scene who were also freaks, who were also separated from their families, and they became my extended family. And so I did find that, you know, making work, communicating through these forms is just a kind of like ruminating over the human condition and also expression. Music allowed me to express a lot of joy, a lot of anger. You know, a lot of those early songs were very, very didactic
yeah.
and very like a teenager wondering what it is. Like my first song was about, you know, a kid having to hide in the closet, be in the closet. It was a coming out song called Closet Door.
Yeah.
You know, I would yeah. sing a lot about like political situations. There was, I look back and it's pretty cute. You know, I saw an interview online where I'm a teenager and I'm being interviewed and I seem so thoughtful and trying to choose my words and stuff like that. But I look at those performances and they were full of like super didactic words.
Well,
I sung atonally and screamed mostly.
Yeah. yeah.
And so I think all of these, and I even, you know, we knew each other at CBC.
Yeah.
I consider my broadcasting work one of the colors in my palette, you know.
Well,
it's an art, it's a discipline, it's an art practice.
Yeah. Like I first encountered you, I think I first encountered you seeing videos by Bob's Your Uncle. Is that possible? I feel like that's the case.
This is all pre-internet. So if you saw it, that's great. I don't even have copies.
No, I saw it on Much, and I don't remember if it was before you arrived there. I watched Much Music, I guess religiously is a word you could use. Like I downstairs, since we moved to Alberta, like I have all these VHS tapes
oh, wow.
that came with me, and like I have so much of Much Music just recorded. I would record it if bands I loved were, you know, you hosted The Wedge. You stuck out to me as a really excellent and forward-thinking personality. I always appreciated you on there. And I also, like, as you're speaking, I wonder if the intensity and volatility of your upbringing has pushed you to extremes to some extent. Like, we talked about the dynamism, and I do think that perhaps in feeling insecure, not in an emotional sense, but, like, having a life that is volatile, I ponder this sometimes myself. Do I try to do as many things as I can within the cultural realm in case one of them blows a tire and gives out? Like that way, like I'm a filmmaker, I'm a musician, I'm an actor, I'm a visual artist, I'm a broadcaster, I'm a writer. I can do those things and teach myself to do those things, which is a form of self-reliance. But if like so many industries right now. Like, imagine we added restaurateur to that list, and that had to go away because there was a pandemic. You've set yourself up to be so self-reliant by entering all these realms that I feel, again, I'm talking about this maybe in a practical manner. I'm sure this wasn't your motivation. It's not mine to do as many things as I can either. But when I think about it, if one of the things I know how to do stopped, I know I can do a few other things. Does that give you any security in life to know that, like, okay, if all else fails, I know I can do these other things? Like, does that help you in some way?
No, not at all. I think being an artist is entirely precarious.
Yes.
Like, everything, like, I've never, you know, if I really wanted to make money, I probably would get a practical thing like learn plumbing.
Just like our parents told us to. Like, that's part of where I'm coming from with it. Like, our parents drilled, I don't know, it sounds like you had the same experience. They drilled that into my head. You know, do something practical. Even when I went and got an English degree halfway through, my mom was like, perhaps you could be a dentist? I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm just, that's not my interest. I need to do something fulfilling. But then during the low points, career-wise, you know, vocationally, I'm like, ah, shit. I probably should have listened to them. Do you ever have that?
Like, no, not at all. Okay. I think to answer your question,
yeah.
I was a child who played a lot. You know, I made music with my neighbor, Julie, my best friend. I put on plays, put on performances. Julie and I would meet in the basement, and have like ongoing days and days of us living an alternative reality. We were 17-year-olds living in the city, sharing an apartment. So we would have this. And that life was equal to our own life. It was like almost like we're living quantum realities. So play was super, super important to me as a child.
Like theatrical play, you mean, kind of?
No, just the act of playing.
Just playing. Oh, okay.
Just playing. And that's the thing is Adam and I were great playmates.
Yeah.
He's like my twin flame and the person who would drop things in a heartbeat to play with me.
Right.
With it, people forget. Children know, but people forget.
Yeah.
And so I think making stuff is an extension to that. I do have an incredible force to communicate and also ponder and share. And these things take different forms.
Yeah.
And I am very interested. I think I'm a storyteller and a communicator. And each of the forms offers different parameters. And each of those forms influences the other. So when I started doing radio, writing my scripts for what I would say greatly helped my screenwriting capabilities.
Right.
My dialogue writing.
Yeah.
You know, writing a set list as a musician has everything to do with editing, has everything to do with understanding arc of story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it may seem like 12 disparate songs, but you can bet that musician who is writing a good set list will have an arc, and you will feel a kind of arc of the story through those things. So I'm very interested in, you know, the capacity of each medium. And one of those, I'm reminded of when I was going to school, they would ask you to answer all these questions and then spit out what you should do with your career.
Yeah.
And invariably it would be something that I really didn't want to do. And it freaked me out.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm not really a person. Most people can kind of very focus on one thing and do it well. I'm a kind of person that really loves many forms. I feel myself a perpetual student. And, you know, I've not gone to school for any of these forms. I've not gone to broadcasting or film or art school.
Yeah.
But in life, just applied myself and learned about them. And each of these forms offers something different as well.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, this idea of practicality, I'm thinking about Brian De Palma, the filmmaker.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to study under him for a short while.
Oh.
And he always said, you know, in the world of movie making, don't put all your eggs in one basket because you never know what's going to heat up.
Yeah.
So you have a bunch of projects on the go because you don't know which one's going to take off.
Right.
In that regard, it's helpful to have, you know, I pretty much grew up thinking I had no practical skills, you know, and then I was like, oh my God, I got this job. This is awesome.
Yeah.
And I still felt like, you know, I still feel I have no practical skills. These are very specific things.
I feel like we're meant to think that when we're in the arts, and it's really dispiriting that we fall for that. Like that I, you know, we kind of feel like, I still sometimes think I fell ass backwards into that CBC work. But then when I think about it, well, no, people see things in us that we don't see. They see talent, they see skill, and that's just the way it is sometimes. I don't know if it's Canadian humility or what, but I do think people see things in us that we don't necessarily think about. We're too modest to talk about.
I think we do learn skills of which we're unaware of at the time. Like, I see these funny lists that are like, careers you should not be going into right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, check, 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 broadcaster.
Yeah.
You know, artist, musician. They're looking at all the things that are sort of in decline. You know, that's what I do. At the same time, we do have gifts of communication. I think I have skills around, you know, it's been interesting during the pandemic. I've been, people have reached out to me to, you know, interview people. Various
panels. I get asked to do panels sometimes. They're just like lots of panels and interviewing others for other things other than, you know, my own pursuits. Do you get that?
Yeah, I get that. You know, the thing with me is, my skill set is very specific. I'm a terrible, put me in front of the camera. I'm great if I can come up with my own stuff. But,
yeah,
you know, I can't read teleprompter. For some reason, it just taps into, in my brain. I can't read teleprompter. I sound wooden.
Well, this is what I want to.
I can't read somebody else's work.
I want to ask. Yeah, you are you're like me in that regard too. I'm a less successful version of you. But we have.
That's not true.
We have an independent spirit, and we need to do things a little bit on our own. I know that about ourselves, and I don't want to dwell on this too much. But the Much Music thing. I have said this to other people over the last few years. I feel like the rawness and freedom of Much Music is something that anticipated a little bit of the way people express themselves on the internet now.
And yes, for sure.
I'm sure you must have, you know, a balance of feelings about your time at Much. But did that feel like, were you ever there thinking like, I can't believe they're letting us do this? Like, did you have those moments, or were there parameters we didn't see? Because it did feel very freeform. I know this also from working at CBC. There were things, when I first got there, I was in a place where we could do whatever we wanted and experiment, and then it shifted a little bit into like, no, we don't do that. You have to do this. And I'm sure you've had that in both those environments as well. But just sticking with Much, do you view that as something, I don't want to use the word revolutionary, but I feel like it anticipated things that we're all,
yes.
You feel that way? Okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was unscripted television.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a microcosm of chaos. You know, I had been doing my work as an artist, music and stuff and films. And then I got this opportunity. Moses Neimer saw my work and offered me the job. And really, I didn't know very much about Much Music and City TV at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is a great thing because, you know, everybody wants to leave their hometown at some point.
Yeah.
And I was like, this could be cool. You know, when I left home, I was living in poverty. And, you know, the one thing was I couldn't afford a TV, nor did I want to watch a TV.
Yeah.
You know, I was way more interested in the life of my friends and my own, you know, making art and being part of the very, very neat art community in Vancouver. So it was very different from my childhood where I was legitimately a TV addict. Mm. I learned so much from television.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, at that point I was wondering, gosh, you know, what can I express? What can I express in this very mainstream art form? You know, I took the gig because I thought, well, this is one bastion I have not yet explored. What can I communicate in this medium?
Yeah.
And I took that job. I told Moses that I'm not a model, clearly.
Yeah.
And I can't read other people's words. And he was a guy who was just very innovative. He's like, that's not what I want. I want you.
Yeah.
I want you to do what you do.
Someone seeing something in you that maybe you're not, you're only aware of an ember of it, and they see something.
And he was a kind of guy who was like very much a Marshall McLuhan-esque type person.
Yes.
Like the medium is the message.
Yeah.
And he loved the idea of breaking down the walls of the studio, going freeform. He would hire or find interesting people, with a, you know, that intrigued him, throw them on air And he loved to see them sync because his idea was like, you know, people will watch you sink, but they'll also watch you learn to swim.
Yeah.
And in doing so, you know, grow to love you and become endeared to you.
Yeah.
And so there were infinite hours of me just trying to kind of, you know, occupy, you know, fill space. And I would do that in the spirit of a performance artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
So I do all kinds of weird experiments, you know. The building was wired to be televised, both across the street, cameras pivoted at the building. I would do strange things like social experiments where I would lie down in the middle of, you know, rush hour on the sidewalk as if I had collapsed to see what would happen. And invariably, people walked over me.
Yeah. Well, it's Toronto. Yeah.
Yeah. And just all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I, you know, was able to make a TV show called Eyeball Theater.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I just sort of like grabbed a camera and did this sort of very personal diary, video diary.
Right.
You're right. This sort of unscripted live TV was a predecessor of what so many people are doing online right now.
That's what I see all the time. And I really like that's within me. Like much was really firing on, like there's people who are listening now who might be like that channel that I never watch or that only plays whatever. But like, I don't think people recognize just how magical it was. And like, I would just watch it for hours. Like, just like, I couldn't. It was so interesting and fascinating. And the access you had to artists, obviously, not just you, but the network. Like, it was totally fascinating. And
well, they let people free, you know. So yeah. You could see there'd be an incredibly different variety of styles of interview because each of the VJs were really pretty much, it's up to them, the questions they ask.
Yeah,
so there was no teaching. Like you go to CBC and they have all these people coming in to teach you.
Yeah,
there was no teaching at Much Music. It was just like, you go and do it.
But
you
know, it worked.
It worked because it was like you felt the freedom and it was exciting because you weren't sure what would happen next. I mean, people still stop me on the street. They recognize me and they say stuff like, oh, yeah, I still remember when you showed us how to relieve trapped gas. You know, I had trapped gas and I, you know, in our family, you stick your bum in the air because hot air rises and then you can fart your trapped gas out. And I'm like, oh my God, did I ever have a lot of time to fill?
Well, you know, as I recall, you might have mooned us on your final broadcast day.
I quit during a time when there was a lot of manufactured boy bands and a lot of manufactured music. And then it was like, you know, interviewing the same bands 3-4 times was getting very dull.
Yeah.
I, you know, 9/11 happened. And also I felt that I was perpetually distracted with ADD. You know, every work environment comes with its own, you know, after effects. But this sort of indomitable pop cultural machine and having TVs blasting all the time. I mean, I seem to not be able to hold my attention. So I knew it was time for me to leave,
right.
But on the spur of the moment when I announced it, I decided to moon the camera and I convinced Rick the temp to do that with me as well.
That's
Campanelli.
Right. Yes, that's right.
And then in retrospect, I looked at it and it was like more than a moon. Like more than a moon.
It ended up being more than a moon. That's a fair way of characterizing it for sure. Yeah. Yeah. But it was a great run you had there, and your CBC run was also very innovative and interesting.
I took a little time off to kind of like get my brain back after Much Music, and then I got the job at CBC.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about, when you first were working there, it felt free.
Yes.
I do believe, I forget the name of it, but it was like very innovative. CBC Radio 2, I think, had a kind of digital videos and very free exploration of music.
CBC Radio 3 was where I worked. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
and there
yeah.
there was one, there was a name of it where it was just like, okay, because the guy who worked with me at Much Music went to CBC.
Right.
Steve. And he started this other kind of like style, this portal where it was a free for all of very interesting stuff. And it was very, very popular.
It
People
was good.
Loved it.
We liked
it. But then, I don't know what happened. Then the power infrastructure, who knows, went, oh, this is a good thing. Let's change it.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a popular thing. I will say that. I think it was a good thing, and we all enjoyed it. And but I don't think it was as popular as they wanted it to be. And but I viewed it as, you know, I got to have breakfast with No Means No, who didn't do stuff like that. And they were like, yeah, we'll talk to you. And it was great. Like, I had a show where I just had breakfast with people and recorded it and then made it into a radio show. And they let me do it. And, you know, some of my friends were like, No Means No is doing that. Like, just certain artists would do it. And they were like, how is this even possible? I'm like, I don't know. And so there was a wackiness to it and a fun part of it. And then it shifted, and it is what it is. I don't really pay attention to what's happening there now to a great extent, but I, you know, I wish everyone well, but it was fun. And it also, I wrote a radio play for Christmas time. And so there was just this ability to do theater and experiment and try to have fun and do comedy and music and books. And I appreciate that. So I think on that level, I relate to you. And as I was listening to Juge 2, and also the first record, which I will call Zhuzh, just to change it up, I was fascinated by your voice. You have these amazing voices. Like, every song has its own kind of character, it feels like to me. Can you talk about your singing voice on this project and how you worked with Adam to make these records? Because, I don't know, like, on one point you sound like Diamanda Galas. On another, it's like a more classic, you know, singing voice. I don't want to cite anyone particularly, but like, I'm just from Nick Cave sometimes. Like, there's just so many different influences that I pick up on that I don't even know if you like them necessarily, but I hear, like, I'm like, is this still my wife? I had the first record on upstairs, and she's like, this is Sukyin? I'm like, yeah, it's the same. Remember I was playing Juge 2 in the kitchen? She's like, it's the same. Wow, I didn't know. She knows you, obviously. Everyone in Canada knows you, for crying out loud. But she was like, I can't believe this is her. And I feel like people will be listening and pick up on that. Like, who is this, the same voice?
Well, I mean, that's the funny thing, is like, a lot of people either they know me from CBC or Short Bus.
Right. For those who don't know, Short Bus was a film you made, and it is, I suppose, infamous, controversial. There is some sexuality, shall we say? More than a moon. More than a moon. Can we say
more
that?
More than a moon. Yeah. Much more than a moon.
Much more than a moon.
Yeah, it was like a very groundbreaking LGBTQ comedy drama.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, very, very well beloved movie.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people know me from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I made two movies with John Cameron Mitchell, the filmmaker, the American filmmaker, and Short Bus. So they know me from CDC or Short Bus or Much Music. Little do they know, I mean, many people, I mean, but more on the underground tip, would know me that my primary beginning communication was with Bob Zirong, was as a musician in Vancouver's underground.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people are surprised. Like, they're like, what? I didn't know you do music.
Didn't you do,
the core.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of which all of this comes from.
You did some work with Dale Morningstar too. Yes. Is that right?
Yeah. I've worked with Dale we're very good friends. I've worked with Bill Frisell. I've worked with John Zorn. I've done Plunderphonics with John Oswald and David Prentice, and worked with CCMC in improvisational music context, Michael Snow. I do solo work. I score all my movies. So in behind all this stuff, it's kind of like little known that people know this. And so I think people will be quite surprised.
Yeah.
Some people.
Yeah.
Some people are like, oh yeah, no, they know me from that realm because they're dialed into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it is like a huge part. It is potentially, like you say, that's the core. Everything else, you know, is almost an extension of that musical core. Is that fair?
It is totally fair. And I was very lucky to, inside of me, I have this sort of a barometer. It's like this pitch frequency. When I sing and it's from the heart and soul and feels right, which is not all the time. Believe me, I've stared out at audiences and totally not been in the pocket and been more interested in what's going on over there in the back of the room than singing.
Yeah.
But when I am able to perform and sing from my gut and inhabit that with presence and feeling and rootedness, there is a feeling that emanates from me.
Yeah.
And I apply that feeling to all of my work, to when I'm acting in a movie, The Take, where that pitch resonates is the take that is good. It is what I strive to hit when I make a film or any piece of work. If I can feel that resonant frequency, that guides me. And that's just a sort of subjective, have I hit the mark or not?
Yeah.
And so that I'm lucky to have that as a sort of sense and a barometer.
Yeah.
But in terms of the various vocalizations, like I'm jettisoned back again to my childhood. I love to sing. I loved singing in the shower because of the reverb mm-hmm. of the tiles. Mm-hmm. But my best friend Julie and I, who I've known since I was zero, we used to pretend that we were quote unquote French showgirls. And we sang in onomatopoeia. We didn't know how to speak French, but we just sort of made up this language.
Yeah.
And I would sing as a French showgirl, stand at the top of the slide and sing really loudly, and then slide down, during which time she had climbed the slide, made her way to the top, and I would say, "Take it away, Julie." And then she would sing in her onomatopoeic other language. And we'd get progressively louder and louder and louder and louder to a point where the neighbors would phone my mom to complain. And though my mom was a volatile person, she knew and was wise to say, "Fuck you" to the neighbors and let us sing
yeah.
loudly. She found it really fun and
yeah.
funny
yeah.
and wonderful.
Are you still friends with Julie?
We've drifted apart.
Oh, okay.
I see her infrequently. We kind of live very, very different lives. And I do feel like there was a point when I moved away from home that it was almost like a clear separation was made.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I have to deal with that. I have spoken with her in the last few years, but our life courses are so vastly different. And then I'm even slowly, like there was a very big break in my family and there's entire areas of relatives that I'm unable to see.
Oh no!
Because it brings up very difficult things for me.
I'm sorry your interpersonal dynamics are so volatile in themselves, and there's so much pain there. I mean, this work you've done with Adam is really excellent, and I understand you had to carry on with this particular record kind of without him. I mean, initially because he was busy working on, was it a soundtrack for a Netflix project?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was with Anna Kabazian.
Right. So you went on to make things on your own. How would you characterize any of the themes that we might pick up on? Like I've talked about the voices, which give the songs a certain character, a tone, a mood. But in terms of lyrics, which I believe were primarily your domain, and your voice, how would you characterize what's going on this sequel, if you will, to Jude?
Yes, it was a very dynamic thing, and I should say that I didn't write all the words.
Oh,
so it
okay.
was a very extraordinary experience. So on the first album, I wrote a lot of the words. But, you know, up until then, as I approached songwriting, it would be, you know, lyrics first, and then using a cudgel trying to force those words into a melody. And frankly, I was tired of that approach.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam is a very, very gifted wordsmith, lover of words, primarily a creative writer. And the music that was coming out of us, we were so thrilled by, we were so excited. It was quite a departure from the kind of more slower, moodier, acoustic electro sound of our first album. What was coming out of us was a pure and unadulterated embrace of pop music. Of much of the Adam and I were both creating electronic sonic instrumental pieces,
mm-hmm.
And we were. He was a lover of pop. I'm lucky to have inherited his Spotify account, where he bookmarked all of his favorite albums.
Oh, nice.
His albums stretch so many genres, so many time periods, but at their core, there is a unity that is something very, very incredible and perfect. Perfect music, beautiful music. And, you know, he really loved pop music. He was a big fan of the Go-Betweens, and he loved Roseanne Cash. He loved a good hook.
Yeah.
And myself as well. Like,
yeah.
I work in all these different I like to bring weird ideas to the mainstream. So I've never totally been into, like, just obscure worlds.
Yeah.
I like to incorporate and communicate within mainstream. Mainstream is synonymous with pop hook. I also love a good pop hook. And the stuff that was coming out of us was so propulsive, and the sounds were unlike, they were like sometimes angry, very joyful, sad, deep, but with oomph. And we were like, yeah. And in terms of the melody and lyrics, what would happen was either Adam or I would come up with a sonic fragment. And then we made stuff on our own. You know, we had a studio. I have a studio. Mm-hmm. I engineered the work. We make it on our own time as opposed to paying for an expensive studio where you're just looking at your time watch.
Yeah.
You know, we love to approach music making like a couple of gardeners. We would, you know, debate aspects of the, you know, grow, add, take away, take our time. In this case with the melody, I decided that instead of making lyrics, I would approach first with melody first. And so Adam or I would make a sonic fragment. I would loop that, and it would provide a bed of music for me to be able to play with my voice.
Yeah.
And I approached it with melody first, with melody first, and then spontaneously, subconsciously, lyrics would come up.
Okay.
Stream of consciousness words. And then again, I would use onomatopoeia, going back to the French showgirls, and make enunciations that would sound like words that were not words, that would fit into the melody. And then I would pass that to Adam. And over the last few years, he had really been honing his ability to overhear. He loved to overhear conversations, and snippets, fragments of conversations would inspire and delight him. Weird volleys and combinations of words would attract his writerly ear, and he would write them down. And he had been working on a book of these overheards. And so he had been really honing that practice of listening. And I would pass him that original vocal pass of stream of consciousness words and sounds. And he would literally transcribe what he heard, sometimes directly transcribing what I said, but many times often delightfully coming up with his own, own interpretations of what he was hearing.
Hmm.
And he would pass that back, and it was like, oh man, this is beautiful poetry. This is something very, very special. And then I would, with my ear, my more editorial ear, kind of craft those words and finesse them. I'd pass them back to Adam. He would do the same. And so much of this album bubbles up from the unconsciousness.
Yeah.
We had this wordplay style. I wish we had even come up with a name for it, but we never did. But it was unlike anything we had made. And so it's very much, last night I began to memorize the words, start to rehearse the songs, because I would like to, if this pandemic ends and it's safe to, I'd like to perform the songs.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are many, many words, and I'm starting to piece together what I interpret as subconscious meanings. And, I'm now kind of coming to know these words and seeing what we were saying to each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I'm just like, what the fuck? We didn't even know this. And, you know, throughout that process, Adam and I would so often be looking at each other and go, didn't we just make that? You know, oh my God, that came out. Like, we really didn't feel completely, it felt almost like possession, like it was moving through us. And it's quite hard to memorize all these words, because these words don't necessarily make logical sense, but they make poetic sense.
Right.
And so memorizing them right now is quite challenging and quite beautiful, because I'm saying, oh my God, we just mentioned Apollo. How many times? Over and over.
Hmm.
In so many of the songs, Apollo comes back. And I'm like, who's Apollo? Well, he is the son of Zeus and Leto, the twin brother of Artemis. He is the god of healing, of medicine, archery, music, poetry, and the sun. He is a god of prophecy. You know, I'm like, what the fuck? Because so many of these songs seem to telegraph or seem prophetic in some
right.
regards, you know,
right.
with Wrecking Heart. You know, it was a deep dive into like a no holds barred rock song, a banger of a song,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a song to strut to, a song to run to, a song to feel passionate and anger and joy to. And you know, Adam, when we wrote that, he was like, "Wow, this sounds like a breakup song." And I'm like, "How could that be? Gosh, we are so together right now. This is so weird, but you know, so many of the things telegraph and reveal. You know, Adam and I, after many years of being together, decided to separate romantically, but we were still very much involved in each other's lives and best friends. But there is, you know, the reveal is about the breakup, but then also with a romantic breakup and also instead of separating, just loving one another and allowing us to be, you know, Adam and I were so close, we knew that we had to sort of grow separately and hope to come together again. But there's a kind of point where, you know, we did acknowledge the need to sort of be able to grow independently. And so that song is about separation, but loving and letting go and having no fear. And it is what I have been, you know, challenged to do, not just in a romantic separation, but with his departure from this plane. Yeah. And so, you know, so much joy in these songs that really reflects our experience. And he was so proud of these songs, as am I. And yet there's something beyond us that is being communicated. And I love that his essence, I can hear the kick to his step in the bass in Run Away With Her, you know, and in so many, I do believe that I feel him, his presence. It's not like Adam was, but it's an unexplainable thing. I feel him guiding me. I feel his spirit, his energy. But I also do believe that he exists in those who love him, the memories of those who love him, and in his good work, which is why I really, it was never a question to me. It was just a matter of how, when can I refocus on the album? And when and how can I put it out? There was a label that put out many of my recordings, Last Gang, including our first album and all of our scores, our film scores. But they had been sold by Hasbro. And Chris was just like, you know, we're not in a position to be able to put music out right now. I think it's best you find another place. And I found another really great label that were like, this is an amazing album.
And a return home to your British Columbia roots, no less.
Well, I mean, I approached another one in Toronto, and this was before the pandemic, and they were like, yes, we love this. But then the pandemic happened, and they were like, no, we can't.
Right.
So everything flatlined. I mean, it's an irony, you know, just as music is being so, you know, I think of musicians as they have a lot of resilience, and they're very entrepreneurial. I mean, musicians are really hard hit by this. Not only is our music being got for free, then now we can't. Now the actual singing is dangerous.
Yeah,
and gathering, but still, ironically, it's been such a fruitful time for me. You know, for all of these forms, despite the fact that it's even more difficult to do in person. You know, this marks my return. So we were without label.
Yeah.
And I approached Randy Awada from Mint Records, Mint, who have been so great. They were there when I was growing up in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And Randy has been there through several generations of like DIY indie art and continues to do so. Very good taste, tiny team, Ryan, Adrian, Randy, but committed beyond belief.
Yeah.
And he wrote me back and he was like, I can't tell you how happy I am to receive your email. And they've just only been great.
Mint is the best. So I'm glad that this has worked out. And I want to also say that I appreciate your perseverance, and I appreciate that you've processed this record already on a very deep level, on some level. And I, you know, just the prophetic nature of it and whatnot. I appreciate that you've been able to find the joy in it, because I do hear the joy in this. And and despite the very, very sad circumstances, there's joy. And I feel Adam's joy as well. It's not just your joy. I feel like this connection. So I want to, what did you say it was? Joy. What did you say Juge stood for?
Joy of our joys.
That's right. And that's really, you know, I didn't mean to invoke the term joy, but that is there. And I appreciate that you can see that despite everything that's happened to you and is happening to us. It's really heartening. So thank you.
I mean, life is very complicated, and mine, you know, I feel your gratitude and thanks, and I take it happily. And I also acknowledge that mine is just one story. Everyone's life is hard. We are thrust into this world and it's not going to be easy, and our hearts will break and we will suffer. And there are wounds, yeah, and there is joy and beauty as well in all of this. And we have this opportunity of life, which is incredible and bountiful. And we live with, we dance with these struggles.
Yes.
And
yes.
And I, you know, I do not feel sad for me or sorry. No. I am my byproduct of my life. And I do believe each of us is placed here.
Yeah.
And I do believe on some level, each of us is placed here to learn to love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a hard thing to do. It's so hard.
Well, I appreciate your sort of philosophical perspective on that as well. Yeah, it's important to keep these things in mind, and it is hard. It is hard. Life is hard. We connect with people, we lose them for whatever reason, and we must keep going. So I appreciate that spirit as well. I just want to let people know that Juge 2 is available via Mint Records on April 9th, and I believe people can learn more about it at mintrex.com. Sukyan, if people want to follow you, keep tabs on what you're up to, where's the best place to send them?
Well, these days I'm mostly posting on Instagram, but I do share it to my public Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the sort of visual aspect of that particular form.
Yep.
So they can find me at Sukyan Lee, S-O-O-K-Y-I-N-L-E-E 30 E. There are three E's because Sukyan Lee with two E's was already taken. I added a 30.
There's another Sukyan. Well, I guess there might be. There's a lot of
Vishkanas. Well, it's pretty much like Jane.
Yeah,
in
I know.
The world of China, yeah, and Korea. Like,
right.
Hi, Jane. You know, Lee is like, my name is pretty much Jane Smith.
Right. Same here. That's true, actually. There's lots of Vishkanas. I'm Bob Smith. So we should, yeah, we should, I'll see you at the next family reunion, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. So people can follow you there. If we can go out on a song from Juge 2, I'm hoping you can pick one. And also let us know why you chose it. Is that something you can do?
Well, I would say Run Away With Her. I really love this song. It encompasses the joyful and also reflective. And there's pathos in this song. There is a multitude of emotional timbres, which I feel accurately reflects life. And, you know, I remember tracking this with Adam, and he started to play a bass line. And originally his bass line was very, very busy.
Yep.
And then I was like, okay. I was reminded of living below my aunt, and she would listen to a lot of Chinese pop music, which the bass would just thud through the floor in a very rudimentary way, like just the most minimal bass. Boop, 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 boop. Like country music.
Yeah.
I could hear very basic bass, and I love that style of bass. And so I was like, okay, Adam, break it down to its necessary components. Let's just hear boop, 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 boop. So he put that down, but then he came up with this really beautiful sort of lilting, sort of almost the Cure style.
Yeah, yeah.
Riff,
yeah,
bass,
yeah,
riff line in there, and it just with the beats and the electronics and the voice all come together. And I think of Adam when I you know, this song is an invitation to escape together. The music video that was made by Dylan Gamble and myself reprises all the spaces that we've been walking during the pandemic.
I see.
You know, when we couldn't be around other people, we could at least walk. And when the city, it seemed like the city was empty. And I came to know these very beautiful spaces.
Yeah.
And it depicts walking through beautiful spaces in the city and arrives at the end at Lake Ontario. Right near Adam's memorial bench.
Oh.
And I see Lake Ontario as Adam. And when we arrive there, and every time I go down to his memorial bench, it can be a rainy day. The sun always breaks. The cloud, the rain stops. The sun comes out. Always when I go down there, it's quite incredible.
Wow.
And his totem animal was a duck. And so the ducks always come to say hello.
Hmm.
So even when we were making this video, boom, the clouds parted and there was the most extraordinary sunset. And so I urge people to go check Runaway with her out online. It's on YouTube. It's a beautiful song. And I hear Adam's kick to his step. We danced a lot together. Really love this song for all those reasons.
Wow. Well, okay. You're a magical person, Sukyan. I appreciate this time, and I appreciate your perspective on lots of things. And so thank you. I'm going to play it for people now from their new album, Juge 2. This is Sukyan Lee and Adam Litovitz with Runaway with Her. Sukyan, thank you so much. Best luck with everything, and I hope we talk soon.
Yeah, take good care of Vishen. So great to speak with you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It was very nice to catch up with Sookie and Lee again after many years of not really seeing each other that often. I used to see each other in the building at the CBC studios there in Toronto, the building, not the studios. Actually, we did share a studio, now that I think about it, for her show and the shows that I used to do. So, yeah, I haven't seen her that much. And it was great. Very nice. And I learned a lot. I didn't really know a whole lot about her upbringing, for instance. I feel like I knew a lot about her public career in journalism and music, but yeah, very revelatory, very open, very thoughtful. Thank you, Sookie and Lee, for being on this, the 606th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you like. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram directly at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content, and if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders at via their website, blackbird.ca, liveatmasseyhall.com. Thank you to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists, and also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, for their in-kind support for this show. All of those businesses are linked in the podcast episode post. So wherever you're, ideally, all those links will be there. So if you didn't catch what I said about Blackbird Music or liveatmasseyhall.com, that's a tricky URL to remember, liveatmasseyhall.com. But anyway, it's all linked there. So I hope you will check out those places if you're in the area or just want to learn more. Oh, thanks as always to my friend Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for the show, and you can learn more about him and his wonderful catalog of song at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Sookie and Lee. Check out Juge 2 via Mint Records. And also, if you like what you heard today, never heard the show before, or even if you do listen somewhat regularly, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to keep up with it. And also, tell your friends about the show. If you think they might like it, that is, tell them about it, and hopefully they'll spread the word about it too, if they like it. That stuff all helps, and that's what we do in an arts community. We spread the word about things we like, I hope. Anyway, everything you do means a lot to me, so thanks again. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.